I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to The Connection. Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy is sounding the alarm about a crisis of loneliness in America. He even admitted to his own personal crisis, realizing recently that he was feeling alone and disconnected after neglecting to nurture his relationships because of his focus on his job. Here he is on his own podcast in May talking about his lifelong struggles with loneliness.
Loneliness is something that I have struggled with over the course of my life, starting from when I was a child. Loneliness was a key part of my elementary school experience. And I remember being scared to come to school many days because I just didn't want to feel like I was by myself and I was alone. And, you know, at times as an adult, though, also, I have had bouts of loneliness as well.
Murthy's office has issued an advisory after finding that half of American adults have experienced loneliness, which puts them at risk for depression and anxiety. And surprisingly, it also puts them at risk for heart disease, stroke, and premature death. The advisory calls for policies that reduce isolation and create a culture of social engagement. Well, today on The Connection, what's driving this crisis that predates COVID, and how can we better connect with one another? Let me introduce our two guests. Julianne Holt-Lundstad is lead scientific advisor for the Surgeon General's advisory, which is titled Our Epidemic of Loneliness and Isolation. She's scientific chair of the U.S. Foundation for Social Connection and professor of psychology at Brigham Young University. Julianne, nice to have you with us on The Connection.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And also with us is Eric Kleinenberg. He's a professor of sociology at New York University, author of several books, including Palaces for the People and Going Solo. And Eric Kleinenberg, nice to have you with us on The Connection as well. I don't think we have Eric. Julianne, I will start with you. Are you surprised by these findings, the fact that as this advisory is titled, we're talking about an epidemic of loneliness and isolation?
Well, you know, of course, to a certain extent, I'm not surprised given not only my involvement in the advisory, but also I've been researching this topic for over two decades now, and certainly I'm not the first to be studying this. And so this evidence has been building for several decades, but we're also seeing concerning trends that, of course, are now far more visible and perhaps brought to light by the pandemic, but certainly did not start with the pandemic and started much, much earlier.
What are the drivers? We could do a whole hour on what the drivers are, but what do you see as behind this high level of feelings of loneliness?
You know, it's probably really challenging and difficult to pinpoint, you know, any one factor. But we have tried to look at several trends to give us clues on how to make sense of this. And so I'll just give you a few examples.
Sure.
There's been data that's been collected over the past two decades from the American Time Use Survey. And what this showed was that Americans are spending more time isolated or in isolation, spending less time with family, both inside and outside the home, less time with friends, less time with others, and that this has been, you know, these trends have been building over the past couple decades. There's also data that began even before that, data including that by Robert Putnam that shows trends dating back closer to the 1960s.
He's the bowling alone. Trends. He's the bowling alone,
yes,
guy, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So we see that, you know, Americans are less likely to be belonging to various groups. Of course, he highlights the bowling clubs, but of course, other kinds of clubs and groups in his book. The decline in participation in religion and other faith-based communities. But we also see declines in the size of household and other kinds of indicators. And so Given, you know, a variety of these kinds of indicators of the indicating that we're less socially connected than we have been in prior decades, it's perhaps not surprising that such a high percentage of Americans are also reporting that they're feeling lonely.
And I do want to pick up on that, but let me get to Eric Kleinenberg in on our conversation. And nice to have you with us on The Connection.
Hey, it's nice to be here. Sorry about the technology.
Oh, that's okay. It's live radio, and we roll with the punches. So, Eric, I know you heard a couple of minutes of Julianne talking about some of the drivers of this sense of loneliness and isolation. Let me then ask you about COVID. Of course, we're looking at 3 years post the start of the pandemic. How did that exacerbate people's feelings of loneliness and isolation? So many people were told to go home. Don't talk to people. Don't go to public places.
Look, the loneliness is about a decline in the quality of our connection to people, not just the quantity. The quality of our connection really matters. And it was hard to feel like you had a high-quality connection with people while you were locked down in your home, not going to work, stressed out about the situation and feeling anxious about the state of the world. So there's no surprise that we saw spikes here and there with loneliness during the pandemic. And we also saw a lot of other really serious issues, a spike in anxiety and depression and stress. So we have been through a lot these past few years. I think we're just starting to reckon with the trauma.
Let me ask you both, and perhaps, Eric, I will start with you. And I was thinking about, I hate to start a show talking about, well, what are we talking, what is a definition of loneliness? But I think when you ask people, are you lonely? Do you feel lonely? You might come up with a variety of different answers to that question. Eric, how do you see what loneliness is?
Well, it's obviously quite subjective, and you can only find out if someone's lonely if you ask them and they tell you that they are. But therein lies a bit of the problem with measuring this. People have really different ideas about what it means to be lonely. And moreover, some loneliness might be good for us because, you know, if you're sitting on your couch too much, watching too much television, the loneliness is the signal that your body tells you that you need to get into the world and make better connections with people. So some amount of loneliness might be very productive. The problem is when we have chronic loneliness, severe loneliness, and it spirals into this vicious cycle that leads to withdrawal and depression, which gets you more loneliness. So I think of loneliness as an experience we have when we don't have the quality of social connections and emotional connections that we need to feel good. And different people have different points where that becomes an issue. And the one thing I'd say about the literature here is that so much of our discussion has to do with quantities, how much time do people spend by themselves? How many friends do you have? And, it's very interesting. I wrote a book years ago about the fact that more people are living alone than ever before, and I expected to find all kinds of loneliness in that population. But what people told me time and again is, as lonely as they sometimes get when they're by themselves, there's nothing lonelier than being in a bad relationship. Right? That's pretty profound.
It sure is. Julianne, let me go back to you. And even from my own perspective, I was trying to define, so what is loneliness? And for me, it feels like this a feeling of being invisible, and that you would have no one to talk to if you felt like you wanted to share something, either good news or bad news. How do you see loneliness?
Yeah, it's, I think Eric was, very clear in how this can really be a very subjective experience, and how oftentimes it's defined as the discrepancy between one's desired level of connection and one's actual level of connection. And so because of that, it is such a subjective experience. And it's interesting because, of course, being alone can increase our risk of feeling alone. Right. It doesn't always happen that way. And certainly you can be alone and not feel lonely. You can be alone and not feel lonely. And you can be around others and still feel lonely. And so, you know, we do have to really be careful in distinguishing between them, but also recognizing that both have been linked to risk for our health and well-being. And so we really need to take kind of a holistic approach. And in fact, what I often find is, even though we have such a specific definition in the scientific literature of this, is that we often hear people using the term loneliness to refer to a whole host of ways that we could be socially disconnected from that actual subjective feeling, to being objectively isolated, to having poor quality relationships. And as Eric just touched on, poor quality relationships can carry risks also.
Well, and Eric, picking up on that and something you have said, which is that the quality of our relationships is so pivotal to us feeling connected and to not feeling lonely.
I think that's right. And I think that's probably some of the reason why we see a spike in the loneliness measures on a lot of surveys these days. I think many of us spend a lot of our time on screens and in social media land, where our interaction with other people is strange and often unsatisfying. And I think, you know, there can be a lot of good things about the connections we make in the digital world, but they often feel a little bit saccharine. They're empty calories, and they leave us wanting something more.
Well, and I do want to pick up on that, and I'm also looking at the clock here, but Eric, going back, I mean, it seems there are both positives and negatives that come with social media. I'm thinking about my own life. If there's a medical crisis in my family, I am hooked in a way that I would not be hooked in without social media.
Look, you know, I'm not a Luddite. You'll find me on Twitter and
fair enough.
On Instagram. I'm not like my teenagers who live on the thing.
Yeah.
But you know, I try to use it in a healthy way, because there are so many great things about it. And look, you know, if you're a gay kid in a small town in a conservative community, social media is going to be a lifeline for you. And if you have any kind of illness, but especially a rare one, and you're trying to learn about it and find a community, you know, thank goodness for social media. And, you know, I wrote a book years ago with a comedian about online dating, and that's a great place for people to meet each other these days. There's all kinds of things that, you know, those kind of social media and digital culture do for us that I think we'd be in bad shape without. Just let's go back to COVID for a second.
Well, you know what? Hold on to that thought, only because we're up on a very short break here, and we are talking about loneliness today on The Connection. The Surgeon General says we are dealing with a crisis of loneliness in America. That's Eric Kleinenberg. Also with us, Julianne Holt Lundstad. And we have much more to talk about after this very short break, including COVID and social media and much, much more. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with psychologist Julianne Holt Lundstad. She's lead scientific editor of the Surgeon General's new advisory on loneliness. Also with us, sociologist Eric Kleinenberg, author of a number of books, including one called Going Solo. Eric, let me just pick up on something you were saying right before the break when I had to interrupt you about social media and COVID, if you could finish your thought.
Well, just, you know, since I'm often a critic of the way we use social media, I want to acknowledge that if it weren't for social media during the lockdowns of the pandemic, we would have been a lot more isolated and probably a lot more lonely. I mean, it was really wonderful to be able to connect with people on all variety of apps. And, you know, interestingly, I wrote a paper with a graduate student at NYU named Jenny Lee, where we interviewed a lot of people living alone during the pandemic, and we were surprised to learn how many people said that they actually got more connected to friends and family. You know, they were connected at a distance. It was virtual, but they didn't feel abandoned or lonely in the conventional sense so much as physically lonely from the kind of lack of intimacy and close connection to people. So, you know, that's to say, I think most of the time or much of the time when we're on social media, we're looking for a kind of connection that at the end of the day, we don't quite get. And I really do think that that might be one of the reasons why we see a little some uptick in the loneliness measures out there. But they can clearly do good things for us, too.
Indeed. Julianne, go to you. I want to get your response about social media.
I think he's touching on this, though, but that there's such mixed evidence on this issue. And we found in some of our data evidence in some cases where it helped, evidence in some cases where it didn't help, and evidence in some cases where it actually did harm. Mm. And so, for instance, among one large national study, they found that older adults who were given various tools to connect digitally to others remotely through a variety of means actually were no better off than the ones that didn't get those or didn't use them. And in our survey of 110 countries, we found that in that those who reported basically any level of satisfaction other than or dissatisfaction with their use of the remote and digital tools actually reported greater severity of loneliness. And so it might really depend on how we use these tools, and so it's really, unfortunately, we don't have simple answers that it's, you know, all good or all bad.
Indeed. And Julianne, let me pick up on something. When we do connect online, do we get that kind of little hit of oxytocin that you get when you're with someone in person and you feel a connection or even a love for them? Does that happen online?
So the one thing about oxytocin is that it's often linked to physical touch. So whether that's hand-holding, sitting, snuggling close to someone, or actual, more physically intimate, that these neuropeptides are active and they're highly linked to social bonding. Mm-hmm. And even that is really complex. You know, we don't have time to go into all of the details on that. But the one thing that we don't have a good substitute for through many of these digital tools is actual physical touch. And I think one thing we recognized during the pandemic, as amazing as it was to connect to our friends and family who we couldn't see and those maybe on the other side of the world and being able to touch base with them, that we also really desperately just wanted to hug our loved ones, to reach out and hold someone's hand. And that in many cases, those tools were just a poor substitute for that.
Let me pick up on something. Then I do want to play another clip from the Surgeon General, and I'll go back to you, Eric. And I'm thinking a lot of workplaces, this one included, are trying to figure out how to bring people back and how much people work at home and how much they work in person. By having a kind of hybrid workplace, are we missing out on something about connection and even maybe exacerbating human loneliness?
Well, I really think that our lives are diminished when we don't have relationships at work. That said, for a lot of people, going to work is a real hardship. I mean, I think what makes people reluctant to go to the office is partly that so many people commute such a long way that it eats up so much of their day. And I guess there's possibilities that people are spending more time, you know, building nice relationships at home or with people in their neighborhood. You know, in New York City, where I live, the central business areas in Manhattan are really diminished, but the outer boroughs where more people live are flourishing in many respects. So there could be some good things, but there's a lot of research we have that shows that relationships in the workplace can be very productive. They connect us to people who are different from us, you know, ideologically, ethnically, religiously, if not in terms of social class. They're often a way that we get a break from relationships in our family and in our neighborhood and can expand our horizons. And clearly, for younger people, relationships at work are really important for things like career development and skill development and, you know, building ties to people who might matter for their professional life. And so I think, again, this is something we're reckoning with. Some cities, the crisis in the work environment is greater than others. But this might be a fundamental shift that we're going to be living with for quite some time.
Let me play another clip from Surgeon General Vivek Murthy, and this is on a recent episode of his podcast called House Calls, and he's describing the ways his wife actually helped him with a bout of loneliness.
There was a time when I was struggling with real loneliness, actually, after my first stint as Surgeon General, and it was my wife, Alice, who really recognized what was going on. And I'll, in fact, tell you how she helped me, because I think that that's a useful model for others. You know, one of the things she encouraged me to do is, number one, just to talk about it, to talk about what I was going through and to think about what I needed. And just being able to talk to her about that sense of disconnection I was feeling was important, because the truth is I felt a little bit of shame around it. And some of that shame was specific to my situation, because I had neglected a lot of my relationships and friendships in the prior few years when I was in government, and I felt some hesitation to reach out to folks now. But being able to talk through that with her was really important. The second thing she did, which was great, is she really encouraged me to spend time with my friends and to reach out to them again. And that was great, because sometimes in a relationship, you can feel selfish to be taking more time out like that. But she gave me the permission to actually go and spend more time with my friends, even though there was a lot going on in the house, because she knew that that was going to be an important part of how I rebuilt my sense of connection. And that was really invaluable.
And that obviously was really invaluable and wonderful to have a partner with such good advice. Julian, one of the things that really struck me with what the Surgeon General was saying was the kind of shame he felt for feeling lonely. And I wonder if you could help us understand that.
Yeah, I think that there's a tendency to put a lot of maybe internal pressure on ourselves, and that when we are lacking connection, that we feel as though we somehow have failed. And so there is a lot of that shame that can go along with it. And I think also part of that is because this is viewed so much as a personal issue. And I think one thing that was somewhat of a silver lining with the pandemic is that because there was an external force that people could look to as perhaps, you know, it's not their fault that they feel lonely. They could say, you know, it's because I'm quarantining and having to limit my contact, that people felt more open about talking about it. And in, you know, whether it's the you know, pandemic or not related to the pandemic, we know that external factors can also impact the various ways in which we can connect. And so perhaps by recognizing that this is more than just a personal issue, this is a community issue, this is a societal issue, that we can be more open and reduce some of that stigma around this issue.
Yeah, and Eric, you want to weigh in on that? Getting past the shame and stigma?
Oh, I think that's, you know, Julian's completely right about that. And I think we have reached a moment where, you know, not necessarily because of loneliness itself, but because of the various stresses that we've faced in the last several years, you know, we're having more open conversations about just what a tough time it is. Clearly, all of us who have children, adolescents, are seeing the struggles that people are having in schools right now. But it's quite widespread, and it can only be good for us to be more open and acknowledging this source of trouble and searching for collective ways to do something about it, which is, you know, for me, the biggest issue.
Sure. And that is sociologist Eric Kleinenberg, who joins us along with psychologist Julianne Holt-Lundstedt, our guest today on The Connection, talking about this crisis of social isolation and loneliness in America, something that the Surgeon General sounded the alarm about just a couple of weeks ago. Eric, if I can pick up on something else, and just sort of broadly speaking, we are a country that seems to prize the individual, you know, to pull yourselves up by your bootstraps, and whatever success you did it because of all the hard work that you did. And that really flies in the face of both human nature and also our evolution. But has that created, do you think, a unique crisis of loneliness because we think we're on our own and we got to do it all ourselves?
You know, I thought that years ago, you know, when I started working on this Going Solo book, I was really persuaded that this cult of individualism in the United States, the hyper-individualistic nature of our society, would make us more prone to do things like live by ourselves and maybe even to experience loneliness. I have to tell you, I was really surprised to learn that, you know, when it comes to loneliness, and especially when it comes to, I should say, to be more specific, when it comes to living alone, America actually ranks far behind almost all of the European countries. We are not the place that where people are most likely to live on their own. And when it comes to loneliness, I think it's a little bit more mixed. I think there's some particular crises we face in the U.S. Related to the stigma. And I think there's parts of the population where it's especially difficult to acknowledge loneliness and to get help. And I guess I'd say one other thing, which is that, you know, we also live in a health system that really doesn't provide enough care for everyone. And so the fact that so few people in the United States feel like they can get good access to care for mental health issues and for feelings of loneliness makes it especially difficult. But I would say the cultural idea that we're worse off in the United States, that's something that I wanted to feeling disabused of.
Well, that's interesting. And I wonder, Julianne, whether you've looked around the world. I actually Googled Finland because apparently Finland is the happiest country in the world just to find out how are people dealing with loneliness there. And sure, you know, they're dealing with loneliness. And in certain ways, it is an existential question about just here we are on Earth. We have a short time and, you know, we live imperfectly.
Yeah. So I've, you know, spent the last few years working with various global organizations. I work with the Global Initiative on Loneliness and Connection, and we're partnered with the World Health Organization to really take a global perspective on this. I also was one of the academic advisors on a Gallup survey on the global state of social connection. And one of the things that we found in the Gallup survey is that that at least when it comes to loneliness, that it doesn't seem to fall along the lines of what we might conveniently categorize into, say, individualistic versus collectivistic types of cultures. There may be something more than just that individual kind of perspective, but that certainly we are seeing trends across the globe. They vary to some extent from country to country. But also we have to recognize that, for instance, many European nations, you mentioned Finland, mm-hmm. Many of them have greater social safety nets and the kinds of programs and services in place that can help people in their countries that that many other countries do not have. And so when we find ourselves in need, if we don't have an existing social circle, whether that's our family and friends, those informal kinds of supports, we need to then, you know, either rely on some kind of social safety net, or we need to have the financial resources to meet those needs. And so these are growing problems that we're seeing in not only our nation, but around the world, as this is also tied to economic factors.
Indeed, you put a lot there. Let me just pick up on one piece, Erica, and I'll go back to you. I mean, and I hear you both saying that loneliness is so much dependent on the quality of our relationships with other people, which does raise a question about, you know, do we know how to be known with others? Do we know how to share with others? Do we know how to listen? Do we know how to be empathetic?
Well, see, now I think you're getting at the deep questions that make this such a complicated issue and makes it difficult to solve, you know, with a pill, you know, or a policy pill, because the truth is that, you know, our species has struggled with loneliness for a very long time. And clearly, our collective anxiety about loneliness really took off when we moved out of our traditional villages and moved into big cities and entered the modern world. And we have been struggling with these kinds of problems for a very long time. And I guess that's why I'm a little reluctant to jump into the language of the epidemic of loneliness. It's why I don't often say, you know, we're lonelier than we've ever been before, because I think the measures are a little bit all over the place and they're inconsistent when we go from, you know, year to year or country to country. But we don't even need that to acknowledge the fact that feeling disconnected, feeling lonely, is a deep and longstanding problem. And the real question, I think Julianne just hit it for us, is how are we going to address it collectively? Are we going to do it by providing a safety net? Are there certain kinds of care we can provide? Or can we also think about building places, you know, building physical places, social infrastructure that helps us gather with each other and find the more high quality connections we need?
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take another short break and pick up on that, get back to our conversation. Here on The Connection, we are talking about loneliness in America, perhaps even around the world. And again, that's Eric Kleinenberg. Also with us, Julianne Holt-Lundstad. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Let me just quickly reintroduce our two guests. Julianne Holt-Lundstad is lead scientific advisor for the Surgeon General's new advisory. An advisory titled Our Epidemic of Loneliness and Isolation. She's scientific chair of the U.S. Foundation for Social Connection, also professor of psychology at Brigham Young University. Eric Kleinenberg is professor of sociology at New York University, author of a number of books, including Palaces for the People and Going Solo. Well, Julianne, let me pick up on what Eric was talking about right before the break, which is, how do we, you know, create this, I guess, culture of connection or address some of the more social or even sociological problems that make it hard to connect with each other? What are your thoughts about that?
Well, so, I mean, one thing I'll point to is, and I know, and I'm you can probably tell I'm almost chuckling as I say it. And that is that I would encourage people to look to the Surgeon General's advisory not only talks about the evidence around this issue, but provides a first ever framework for a national strategy that includes six key pillars. I laugh because I know it's long, it's 80 pages. So many people may not read the whole thing, but certainly we can get some clues from these pillars. One of the things that was touched on was this, this idea of a social infrastructure that I know Eric talks about in his own work. But it's this idea of the kinds of places and spaces and institutions where people gather. And we also talk about the role of policy as well. And, you know, it's interesting because we think of social connection and loneliness as such personal issues. And, that it's a private issue, that certainly the government has no business in our personal lives. But one of the things that the pandemic taught us was that social contact is part of basically every aspect of our lives.
Right.
It altered the way we go to work, the way we work, the way we, our education, our entertainment, the way we shop. Basically, every single aspect of our lives had to be altered when we had to limit social contact. But what that also communicated is that there's social relevance to literally every sector of society. And what that suggests is that each of these sectors of society can potentially play a role. And it may not be the sorts of policies that people think of, like, I often hear people say, you can't put good relationships in the drinking water. And, what are you going to do? Legislate hugs. But what we can do is think about the kinds of policies that limit our ability to connect with other people, whether that's workplace policies that limit our time to spend with others outside of the workplace, or the kinds of infrastructure and how our communities are built. All of these things can influence the degree to which we are able to interact with others and to connect with others. And so it reveals tremendous opportunity for us to really be careful and thoughtful about the kinds of practices and policies and how we design our society.
And those are all important, and I think things that we should all think about. And I wonder to you, Eric, if I can ask you some really basic little questions here. One having to do with stoops and porches. In Philadelphia, it's a city of row homes in many different ways. And people, I think they still sit on their stoops. I hope they do. Porches doing the same thing. Also, talking to strangers. I mean, the idea of being able to connect with people in these small, little, momentary ways. How important do you think that is?
Well, it can be tremendously important in a neighborhood. And, in the Palaces for the People book, which is about social infrastructure, actually write about Philadelphia. And the fact that in a lot of neighborhoods where there was depopulation, when jobs started to disappear from Philadelphia and neighborhoods got hollowed out, you started to see more abandoned buildings, more empty lots. There are many places in Philadelphia where that, remains a problem to this day.
Sure.
And when you have that in your neighborhood, it actually discourages people from spending time outdoors and socializing with each other. And, as Philadelphians know, one recent experiment in the city over the last decade has been, using public money to turn those little spaces with empty lots into pocket parks, to board up abandoned buildings, and to try to revive the street life of a place, really to build up the social infrastructure. And the returns on local life are tremendous. I mean, they help people talk to one another. They also help people feel less stressed when they're in the area, and just encourage people generally to be outdoors. So that's, you know, one of many simple kinds of social infrastructure fixes that we could be doing locally and also nationally. And I just want to note that, you know, we've talked a lot over the last several years about investing billions and maybe even trillions of dollars on infrastructure for this country. We know that our roads are falling apart. We know that our airports and our train systems don't work well, that the power goes out. But we have also neglected to invest in our social infrastructure. And it's, you know, my sincere hope that in this conversation about how we get better connected, we don't just dump the burden of responsibility on the backs of individuals who already feel burdened. We also need to recognize that if we want to help people connect with each other, one thing we can do is invest in things like better updated libraries and nicer parks that are accessible and better playgrounds with updated equipment and no glass and debris on the ground. We just haven't done that in this country in a way that we once did. And I think, you know, we look for other reasons that we all feel disconnected. But one of them is that we just stop contributing to ourselves.
That's really fascinating. And I wonder, Julianne, if you want to add to that.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that brings up is also that there are, sadly, disparities. And one of the things that we consistently find is that people who report greater financial concerns also report greater severity of loneliness. And one of the things that we also see is that not all neighborhoods or communities have equal kinds of parks. And, you know, some communities have more green space, more parks, more libraries, more churches, you name it. And other neighborhoods are more impoverished and don't have those kinds of places to gather, but also their sidewalks may not be as well maintained. And so those with disabilities are less able to get out. And so we have a lot of disparities in our communities. And so we need to also think about how we can reckon with this in recognizing the kinds of factors that contribute to isolation and loneliness and being less connected. And I want to just bring back one issue around living alone. And we need to also be thinking about getting more creative about our housing, because of course that's tied to finances as well as housing becomes less and less affordable. But we do need to note that we have data from over 100 countries that shows that people who live alone report greater severity of loneliness. So, and that's true whether that is by choice or not by choice. We found that people who live alone by choice were still 60% more likely to report greater severity of loneliness than those who live with others. But those who are living alone not by choice, it was 7 times higher. And so there is some risk associated with that, and we need to think more broadly about how we can help people connect.
Well, in fact, let me play another clip from the Surgeon General's podcast where he talked directly about this. In fact, he talked about some of the risks for people living alone and what he did to make sure that he stayed connected while he was living by himself.
We do have to keep in mind that when we live alone, that there are certain things that we have to be more proactive about doing to ensure that we are building connection, like in our lives. Because what the studies do show is that isolation, which can also result from living alone and not having interaction with others, is associated with worse outcomes in terms of mental health and physical health. So in order to address that risk, one of the things I did when I was living alone is I made a particular point to spend time with my friends in person, to call family and friends, you know, every day, to talk to them on the phone. Because I knew, knowing my own personality, that if I didn't do that, if I didn't make it a point to proactively build in that interaction time, that I could go days sometimes without seeing or talking to another person.
And Eric, you wrote a book called Going Solo.
I did. And you know, again, I think this is one of these things where, you know, you can cut it up and look at different populations. And for some people, living alone works really well. And for other people, it doesn't work really well. And, you know, I hate to lump it all together as one kind of collective experience, because it is actually, there is a lot of variation there. But what I think we can acknowledge, and I think we need to, what we need to deal with urgently, is that we do have a real housing problem in this country, because there are so many one-person households. There are a number of people, record numbers of people who are aging alone, and we haven't really figured out how to make sure that people who age alone are connected to their neighbors, are connected to their families. And here's an area where the United States really is a laggard compared to other countries that are experimenting with new kinds of housing that you know, keep people in situations where they can be supported and supportive of one another. And I think every American family that has an older person who's aging and aging alone, and there are a lot of us, struggle with this issue. Many people know that there is a very expensive world of assisted living complexes where quite affluent older people can be surrounded by all kinds of services and programs, and it can be a pretty good experience for what could be, despite what can be a difficult situation. But those assisted living complexes are just about inaccessible to everyone who doesn't have a lot of money. And so how can we start to think about new forms of housing that can tie us together across generations, or that can keep people who are old and alone connected to each other? And how do we deal with housing more generally that doesn't put so much pressure on each individual nuclear family to provide for all of its own needs? We have had periods in this country where we thought much more seriously about what it is to build a community or a neighborhood, how families can help each other out. And, you know, in the last several decades, we have embraced, you know, what some people call neoliberal, more individual-based solutions, more market-based solutions to things. And I think we are reeling from the damage of all of that. And this is a moment where there's a lot of uncertainty and a lot to be worried about, but it's also a moment in our history where we can be very creative and start to think about new models for how we rebuild and what we do coming out of this pandemic crisis. So although I think the threats are really serious, I think it's wonderful that we're here having this conversation, that we have a Surgeon General who's taking the issues seriously, because we could really do something different in the years to come.
And what an exciting thought, especially if we end up doing that. Julian, let me ask you actually a personal question. And I saw an article in the American Psychological Association a number of years ago, and you talked about the fact that at that time your husband was very ill with cancer. Happily, he's not, as I understand it. But you had to reach out for help. And it was hard for you, and I don't think you're alone in that, but I wonder if you could just talk a little personally about what that was like for you.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because here I am, a researcher who has been studying the importance of social support for your health, and I'm facing this crisis with my husband, who was stage 4, in critical condition at the time my kids were 4 and 8.
Oh, gosh.
and I desperately needed help. And yet I felt this difficulty in, and it wasn't that I didn't have people that I in my life. I have, you know, a large family, they're, you know, friends, but I didn't want to be a burden to others. And it's really difficult to ask for help. And I remember one of my dear friends saying to me, you know, we all feel helpless. We want to help. Let us do this for you.
Wow.
And, you know, it was such a good reminder of, you know, we often have these barriers to asking for help because we don't want to be a burden. But people really sincerely do want to help. And so, you know, when you have people around you, accept that help because it can be so incredibly beneficial. But I also recognize how many people may not actually have others to rely on who are offering. And that, you know, can be really difficult to then ask for help from strangers or from, you know, some kind of institutional help, because you feel like you can't solve your problems on your own. We live in a culture that values self-reliance and independence. These are barriers to us being interdependent, and that we can rely on each other, and that these kinds of experiences, you know, and I found from my own experience, actually brought me so much closer to many of those relationships in my life.
Well, we have to leave it there on a high note. Julian Holt Lundstedt, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection.
Thank you.
And Eric Kleinenberg, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. Our engineer today, Al Banks. Debbie Builder is the senior producer. Paige Murray Besser, the producer of The Connection. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.